Привіт, це подкаст «Коли все має значення». І мене звати Наталя Гуменюк.
А я Ангеліна Карякіна. І сьогодні ми говоримо про чергового гостя Наталки, історика, інтелектуала публічного Тімоті Гартон-Еша. Наталко, моє перше питання до тебе, коли нам здавалося, що ніби ми все про цей світ вже розуміємо, все написано, кінець історії і так далі. От історики, які займаються сучасною історією, вони взагалі розуміють, що відбувається зараз?
Мені здається, що якраз вони дуже добре розбираються. Тімоті Гартон-Еш – британський історик, він насамперед історик 20-го століття і процесів, які були пов'язані з демократизацією Європи, Центральної Європи, Східної Європи, в часи Оксамитових революцій, в часи того, що ми називаємо тим періодом падіння Британського муру, але, звісно, і досліджували Другу світову. Тімоті Гартон-Еш взагалі-то є, по суті, вчителем Тімоті Снайдера. Якраз він сьогодні, одна з ключових думок, якою він намагається достукатися до британського суспільства, до європейського суспільства, про те, що великі війни можливі сьогодні.
Дякую. Ми в курсі.
Ми якраз в курсі, але це саме те, що, мені здається, дуже багато людей в сучасній Європі не розуміють. І він з історичної перспективи говорить, ні-ні-ні-ні, великі війни – це не щось з історії.
Ну, мається на увазі великі війни не лише та війна, яка зараз відчувається світом як війна між двома країнами – Росією і Україною, а взагалі більша, тобто щось типу світової війни.
Власне, я його і просила пояснити, це не те, що мені дуже треба розуміти, чому війна проти України така важлива. Я просила його пояснити, як він комунікує своїй аудиторії, чому ця війна не просто війна між двома країнами, чому вона відрізняється від інших воєн, і чому вона насамперед найбільше схожа на Другу світову, як війну, в якій треба перемагати.
Ти з професором Тімоті Гартоном Ешом не вперше спілкуєшся, багато років береш у нього інтерв'ю, перетинаєтесь ви на різних подіях. Я постійно тебе питаю, але все-таки сіль цієї розмови. Що для тебе було новим, відкриттям?
Насправді, та чіткість, з якою він може пояснювати оцю історію безпеки і озброєння. Ми багато говорили про зброю, чому зброя потрібна. Можна сказати, він доволі критичний до влади сучасної Європи і сучасного світу, бо він серед тих, хто публічно постійно від початку війни наполягає на тому, що потрібна зброя і що має це робити весь континент. І у цій війні треба перемагати. Але він і пояснює, що саме поняття там розвитку демократичної держави, воно не суперечить тому, що держава має озброюватися і бути сильною.
Захищати себе.
І оце поєднання, що демократичні країни звикли бути сильними. І, скажімо, під час Холодної війни були арсенали, були готовності, і це не заважало цим країнам залишатися там ліберальними, розвиватися. Ось це важливо, тому що, здається, за останні, особливо там 30 років, якась там зсунулася через брак, можливо, загрози, рамка того, що або ми такі войовничі і недемократичні, або ми не воюємо і демократичні. З точки зору такого ліберала-інтелектуала пояснити, чому зброя є, може бути частиною демократичного суспільства, мені здається, що не так мені, а як якісь теж аудиторії інші, важливо знати.
Він насправді виступає на багатьох публічних подіях, на яких присутні в тому числі світові лідери, президенти, керівники урядів і так далі. Тому дійсно важливо, як це звучить. Те, що він розуміє, що ці війни можливі, це зрозуміло. А от ти його питала, чи світ розуміє, якого рівня це війна і до чого вона може призвести, які її загрози, чи світ взагалі усвідомлює, в якій точці зараз знаходиться?
От тут просто не треба, певно, говорити про те, який світ. Він трошечки зміг пояснити і сказати, знаєш, що є ті люди, які не розуміють, є ті люди, які опортуністичні, зокрема при владі певних країн і інституцій, а є ті, хто дуже добре розуміє. Тому, напевно, варто уникати якихось узагальнень, в стилі Європа, Західна Європа. Ми цього разу спілкувалися онлайн, перед цим його бачила на Мюнхенській конференції безпековій. Саме було трошки приємно і цікаво, бо ми піднімалися в ліфті на місце, де був Захід, і зайшов саме президент Чехії Петр Павел, якого Тімоті добре знає, бо він якби з оцього середовища Чехії, яке боролося за демократію, тобто це якийсь давній знайомий, і він так привітався, як з давнім знайомим, добрий день, це Наталка, я одну секунду поговорила, і ми вийшли з ліфту. Але я розумію, що він починає розповідати, що, наприклад, Петер Павел розуміє і робить якісь речі. І ось ця думка про те, що не треба узагальнювати в деяких речах і, можливо, десь покладатися на людей, які розуміють дуже добре, а десь бути критичними до таких лідерів, як сучасний лідер Німеччини, до якого Тімоті Гартон Еш дуже критичний. Ось це важливо. Ну і я ще запитувала про вступ дружина Тімоті Гартон Еша. Вона полька, вони живуть все життя майже в Оксфорді, але Польща для нього дуже близька, зрозуміла країна. І я, зокрема, запитувала також про українсько-польські відносини в контексті протестів польських фермерів. От мені було, наприклад, теж цікаво говорити про те, як має Україна вступати до Європейського Союзу в умовах, коли з одного боку вона достойна певних послаблень, тому що в нас війна. І чому саме її вхід в Європейський Союз може бути винятком?
Слухай, у тебе майже про кожного з цих гостей є якась прикольна історія, цікава, людська. Чи є в тебе така про Тімоті Гартон Еша? Ну, про ліфт, да, окей, приймається. Мені... Або історія знайомства.
Ні, мені здається, що дуже було цікаво, коли він, власне, я перший раз щось говорила з ним, коли зустрілася і згадувала про Снайдера, і він так знаєш, так казав. Ну так, там Тім, мій вихованець. Да? Ну, треба розуміти, що Тім дуже поважна людина, але він залишається, як і багато з нас, ми, здається, стараємося про багатьох наголосити, він приїздить в Україну, він спілкується з солдатами, він спілкується з військовими, він бере інтерв'ю, він їздить на місце, йому зараз 68 років. І він працює в полі, він, звісно, там за певних обставин, ну, чесно, треба зрозуміти, що це все-таки вік. Якби ні, то він, напевно, більше був десь там на місцях. Але це теж, знову ж таки, показник, що от люди працюють в полі, історики світові, і їм важливо зустрічатися з купою народу, коли вони приїжджають. І
куштувати херсонські кавуни.
І херсонські кавуни, і знайомитися. І що важливо, що він якби продовжує для себе відкривати Україну. Тобто для нього це не... Таке, я британський історик, я досліджував Східну Європу, апріорі я знаю дуже багато про неї. Він якби дивиться на історію втяглості, так, щось сьогодні інше, і потім далі змінюються, ну, якісь події, і нам треба їх знати з місця події, а не просто мати от якісь усталені свої думки і просто їх переказувати на сторінках шанованих видань.
Добре, давайте слухати розмову Наталки Гуменюк з професором-істориком Тімоті Гартон Ешем.
So thanks so much for joining, and pleasure as always to talk to you, and congratulations with the award. So what the award is? Is it for your latest book?
It's for Homelands, a personal history of Europe. It's called the Lionel Gelber Prize. It's probably the best non-fiction prize for English language non-fiction. I mean, Anne Applebaum got it for her book about the Holodomor. But as important, the book is coming out in Ukrainian, and it will be out with Vivat in May, so I'll be there in May.
Looking forward. But I'll probably start with this. You know, the last time I had a chance to finally meet my editor at The Guardian, at the opinion page, and he right away started to speak about you, saying that you like one of the very few people who really, while writing, doing something very important, more or less explaining to the younger generation in Britain and of the audience of The Guardian, which is, you know, one of the most popular publications globally, that, you know, the war is possible, that, you know, it's not theoretical, the threat is there, and it's not something which was in the history. If you really summarize, what is your main message to the general public in the UK and also the other generations in Europe who enjoyed so many years without war being in their homes? They still enjoy the war being not in their homes, but still, what do you want to say to them?
It's really interesting, Natalia, because I've taken to asking audiences wherever I go a simple question. Is Europe at war? I did it at the Munich Security Conference where we last saw each other, and most people said yes, they put up their hands. I just did it a couple of days ago in Brussels, the capital of the European Union, and I would say slightly under half the audience put up their hands, right? So that's what we're up against, that people still kind of think of it as a war in a faraway country. You know, there's a war in Ukraine, and there's a war in Gaza, and there's a war in Somalia, and so on. And what's behind this is this. wake up, guys. We have the best Europe we have ever created. Those who are lucky enough still to live in a Europe of peace and prosperity and freedom. But it's all under threat. And we could lose it quite quickly if we don't watch out. That's no news to your, you know, listeners in Ukraine, but it's news to a lot of people in Europe, because most young Europeans regard what we have, you know, in Paris or in Berlin or Rome as normal. And what you have to get across to them that is that in historical terms, it's deeply abnormal. And so unless you get that sense of the historical perspective about how abnormal it is, the kind of Europe we've created inside the European Union and NATO, you can't actually get that sense of urgency and threat. And I think we've got a hell of a way to go. I think it's there in, you know, in the Baltic states and in Poland to some extent, but it's not yet there in Germany or France or Britain or Spain.
But how would you elaborate? Because I understand that while sometimes some pundits or even Ukrainians, or not just Ukrainians, speak about like the biggest war in Europe after the Second World War, you know, it becoming complicated with the Balkans, because as if like there was no big wars in the 90s, there were those big wars and Europeans also fought wars elsewhere. Why are you, you know, insisting that this is the threat, and how also you answering this question? Why all of a sudden the war against Ukraine is this tectonic and important, but the other wars where also people suffer, you know, they're also utterly unfair and tragic. Why you kind of try to make this awakening call with this one?
What happened in Bosnia and other parts of former Yugoslavia and also in Kosovo was utterly terrible. It was going back to the worst of Europe. But we got through it. NATO intervened to prevent a genocide in Kosovo. You know, NATO, the international organizations are still there, remember, to try and keep the peace. And it just wasn't on the same scale. Milosevic was a war criminal, a tyrant, but he wasn't a danger to the whole of Europe in the way that Vladimir Putin clearly is, because you know, it's not just the scale, and scale matters, of the war in Ukraine, which is just enormous. It's emptying the cupboards of the defense establishments of the entire West. That's a sense of the scale of it. It's genuine the case that Britain's cupboards are getting bare. And, you know, Mette Frederiksen, the Prime Minister of Denmark, said Denmark is giving its entire artillery to Denmark. It's also that Putin, if he succeeds in Ukraine, will clearly not stop there. We don't have to say it ourselves. He's pretty much saying it himself. Next stop, Moldova, probably, or wherever it may be. So that the scale and the fact that the threat is directly to the whole of Europe is really quite different. So what I say is that there's a distinctive period of European history, which is what I call the post-wall period. The period that starts with the fall of the Berlin Wall on the 9th of November 1989, and I argue ended on the 24th of February 2022. So we're in a new period of European history. And for all the horrors of former Yugoslavia, that wasn't the case there.
You're speaking about, like, the people say there is no war, and I would partially understand it, but maybe we could also think about this war also being kind of different just because we're living in the different age. I think like you were in Kyiv, you understand that how normal life sometimes looks like. You know, we can have the communication, we can travel overseas, the borders are open. And I sometimes think that, you know, it's not really about that this is like less violent war. It's just the time allows us to have the air alert on our mobile because it just couldn't be there in, you know, 1942 in London. How would you maybe describe that some things people don't feel it's that big war, but maybe there are just historically things which protect us from having that type of war like it was, you know, with all the deficit and with all the other things we had in the Second World War?
Well, but first of all, you know, Natalia, it's really important. A hell of a lot of life went on quite normally in many places during the Second World War. If you read memoirs, you'll be amazed. You know, if you went to the Ritz one evening in 1943, Or in Berlin. There are memoirs of Berlin in 1943. You know, apart from the blackout and so on and people in uniform, it seemed pretty normal. So that, what you're talking about, like how amazingly normal life seems, particularly in Lviv, of course, but also in Kiev, is a kind of normality of war. There's a great poem by the poet Zbigniew Herbert, the Polish poet, who says, why am I returning to Poland under martial law? Stan wojenny, state of war. He said, because I couldn't stand the tension outside. Because outside, you think everybody must be cowering from the bombs every minute of the day. And it's not like that in wars. It wasn't even like that in Bosnia, by the way. Obviously, at the front line, it was. But the other thing is, here's the paradox of this war. You know, I'm recording this. I'm now going to show you. I'm recording this on my phone. And every single day, first of all, I keep Air Alert on my phone. So I get the air alerts literally multiple times a day. But also I get videos, I get photos, I get clips of all kinds. In a way, that brings it closer, right? Because nobody in London in 1942 had a video clip on their phone, you know, of what was happening in Warsaw. But at the same time, because there's so much of it, and because a video clip from, you know, Kramatorsk looks exactly like a video clip from Gaza or Somalia or wherever it might be, we become simply used to it. So it makes it both more real and less real, actually, war in the internet age.
Would you explain why you keep the air alert on your phone while being where you are in the UK?
Well, not because I have to dash to the nearest bomb shelter in Oxford, because it would take me some time to find one. But because I really want to keep reminding myself every single day of what you're going through, you and your friends are going through. I mean, it's just very important to me personally to be reminded of that every single day.
But how you also would describe this empathy on the, you know, more, I don't know, like national level, because I understand that so much pain is accessible for us in different parts of the globe, thanks to what you said, thanks to technology as well. But this idea that the younger generation today just can't relate to somebody who is, you know, in this situation, because somehow you are, of course, you are a specialist, you're a historian, this part of the world is close to your mind and your heart. Sometimes I think Ukrainians are at this stage, 2 years after the war, first of all, we all appreciated that much of support and solidarity and welcoming of the Ukrainians. But I think it's becoming harder to relate to the people and understand that, you know, why you fully don't understand why Ukrainians are fighting, why Ukrainians are not, you know, living, why Ukrainians insisting on the fact that they need to defend themselves with their arms. I think this is not understood fully by a lot of people in Europe, like why you don't give up, why you are risking your life. Can't you find your way of escaping and doing something? Why there is not this understanding? I'm not really asking about like why there is lacking empathy, but like this misunderstanding and not understanding of this eagerness of the Ukrainians to risk their life.
First of all, there are some people. I mean, we have an amazing student here who was a student of Russian literature. She's called Ada Wordsworth. When the full-scale war erupted, she thought, I can't be sitting here studying Russian literature. And she went to the frontier and helped refugees. And from there, she went to Kharkiv. And ever since, she's been working on reconstruction work for the villages around Kharkiv. So there are, you know, there are quite a few people who really have had that response of solidarity. But I think, well, two things. First of all, you know, this is what happened with Bosnia after roughly 2 years of war. And it's partly a journalistic point, which you will recognize very well as a journalist. Now, the journalists have all written every story at least three times. The frontline story, the hospital story, the underground school story, the concert story, the, gosh, the trains still run on time story. I mean, every single story journalistically has been written three or four times. And so it actually becomes difficult journalistically. And so it slips off the front page, right? Particularly if there's another big war on, like in Gaza. But also what happened with Bosnia was that you had this, if you like, Bosnia fatigue, for want of a better phrase. Yeah, this fading of interest. And then Srebrenica happened. And Srebrenica was so shocking and so unprecedented and took us all back to 1945 that it absolutely galvanized the international community, right? Now, the problem with Ukraine, it's painful to have to say this, is that Bucha happened early on. Bucha was, so to speak, the Srebrenica in terms of its effect, Western public opinion, right? And there have been so many utter horrors since you've documented many of them in the Reckoning Project that in a way people have become inured and it's kind of, you know, it's more difficult to imagine what the kind of individual atrocity will be that would galvanize public opinion again.
But do you see also the change of the kind of attitude of the idea of the war which is should be won, not the war which should be ended in the...
At the moment, because, you know, it's not that there isn't lots of support and lots et cetera, et cetera, but there are basically two lines now being pushed in Europe. One is mine and that of Kaja Kallas and Mette Frederiksen and President Peter Pavel of the Czech Republic and Radek Sikorski in Poland and many others, which is, if you're in a war, you've got to win it. War is not like other activities, right? It's not like, you know, commerce or other peacetime activities, right? There's not a win-win. Either you've got to win it. And those for whom Olaf Scholz is totally emblematic. And I thought Scholz had got a bit better, but he's now got much worse again. Who really are saying, still have this illusion about there's some position of not losing. And that's the real argument. Now, this has something to do with historical memories of war, because the Brits and the Czechs and the Poles and the Estonians drew one lesson from the Second World War, which is if you face invasion, occupation, a brutal aggressor, you've got to fight them and win. The Germans and the Italians, who in that war were, of course, on the side of the aggressor, their conclusion was, war is terrible. Whatever the war is the evil, not invasion or occupation or dictators. And although German public opinion has shifted to some extent, that's still quite strongly there, that, you know, the imperative is stop the war, even by a lousy peace, or so-called peace.
But do you think in particularly in modern Europe with all mentally, we are able to, you know, again, think in the terms of good and evil, that it's not the war what should be stopped, but the evil should be stopped? Because if you really speak about the popular culture, about the, you know, moral and ethics of the people, I think people still believe, you know, the good is good. You know, you shouldn't kill people. You shouldn't do this. But I do understand that there were so much manipulation done under the pretext of the war. It's like a long history, you know, and I understand the trauma of the Iraq invasion to the whole Western world, you know, when you kind of always think that, oh, that we should be cautious. We cannot any longer endorse big wars. And somehow Ukrainians are partially suffering through that huge, you know, tragedy and manipulation. But with what is going on now, this moral clarity and the idea that, you know, the good should prevail, to what extent it can be relatable to the general public in modern Europe?
You know, Natalia, I don't think that's quite the point or the dividing line, because even those who are saying, you know, not lose, negotiated settlement, territorial compromise, land for peace, all that stuff, even they are very clear that Putin is evil and what Putin is doing is evil. So I don't think that's where the dividing line is. The dividing line is about what you have to do about evil, right? And whether war, even the most just war, is intrinsically evil, right? I mean, obviously, war is not a nice thing. It's not a good thing ever. But there's all the difference in the world between a war against Adolf Hitler and, you know, a war against, I don't know, Macron's France or whatever it might be, right? And so I think it's more about the attitude to war and to what it needs, because this is another point which comes out of my book, which is that during these
post-war years after 1989, partly because freedom came so peacefully in 1989, so relatively easily, 1989 to 1991, people started to kid themselves that freedom is a process, that it flows somehow automatically. And as you know very well, freedom is not a process. It's always a struggle. I mean, my all-time favorite word of the last 2 years is volia, your volia, the combination of, you know, freedom and willpower. And so I think it's understanding that, understanding the importance that that freedom is a struggle, and that includes armed struggle, and that you have to fight for it. That's, I think, where the dividing line comes. Plus, by the way, an exaggerated belief in the invincibility of Russia, right? So yeah. People say, oh, but you're going to believe Russia. Nonsense. Russia was defeated in the Russo-Japanese War. Russia pretty much was facing defeat in 1917. Russia didn't win the Second World War. It was the combination of the Soviet Union, which is something else, and the United States, and a bunch of other countries, right? And then Russia lost in Afghanistan, and Russia lost the Cold War. But there is this absolute awe of the kind of mystique of Russian invincibility, plus, of course, nuclear weapons and the fear of nuclear weapons.
Now, speaking exactly about the weapon, because we can speak about these terms. In the end, the war is won by guns, by bullet, by the drones, by everything like that. And what we feel today, that it indeed happens that European defense sector just doesn't have enough munition. And I fully understand, I probably was easier the person understand that you better invest into education, healthcare, other things, you know, climate change is coming. So there is a reason why so many countries, you know, didn't spend that much money on arms. But today it feels like the wrong decision, you know, or like mistake not to have this capability. And you still understand that China and Russia produces way more weapon than a lot of European countries. How to deal with that, and how also you explain the whole idea of weapon for the students, for the Brits, for the peaceful people of Europe?
The peaceful people of Europe, yes. I've often talked about this with Tim Snyder, because one of the disciplines that was totally neglected in our universities for the last 35 years was military history. I mean, everybody suddenly have rediscovered all these terms from military history, and, you know, people are bought out of retirement because they're the only people who understand it, with a few exceptions. I mean, there are some great younger people. Jade McGlynn, for example, is a very impressive British writer on this. But on the weapons, I think it's more complicated than you were saying. Number one, there are things we actually have right now which would really make a difference in this extremely difficult period of the war. Top of the list, Taurus. You know, that leaked Luftwaffe, German Air Force call was incredibly revealing, because these are the professionals, and they said if Ukraine had 15 to 20 Taurus missiles, it could probably take down the Kerch Bridge. Now, Germany has 600 Taurus missiles. And by the way, they sold 397 to Korea. So the missiles are there. So it's a purely political decision by Scholz not to send them. Germany could send 50 or 100 Taurus missiles tomorrow. That would make a real difference, because you could start cutting the supply lines through Crimea. The second thing is the stuff we're really short of, like ammunition. But there you have Peter Pavel, the president of the Czech Republic, great guy, former NATO general, former chair of the NATO Military Committee, who told us at the Ukrainian lunch at the Munich Security Conference, we found 800,000 rounds of ammunition, 500,000 of 155 and 300,000 of 122. All we need is the money. Now, Germany has the money. France has the money. I mean, that money. So again, if we had a sense of urgency and we really understood how important it was, you know, to help Ukraine to win, we could just go and buy that stuff. And then the third level is how we completely ran down our own defense industries, because we were thought we were entering Immanuel Kant's perpetual peace in the post-war era. And that's obviously going to take longer to do. And one reason for the hesitation, apart from the fear of escalation, is that actually people are really getting frightened of Putin. And so one of the arguments is we need to hang on to some of this stuff for our own armies in case he has a go at us. Now, I would argue the way to stop Putin is in Ukraine.
How would also you explain the unity of the whole idea of the European unity is about the alliance, including the alliance for peace in the continent and some of the joint decision. But what I feel now, and I had a chance like just today, talk to one of the people in Ukrainian defense industry. And we have the understanding that in the end, with all the generous support, which is coming from a lot of countries, most of the countries prefer that we give funds, but to buy our own ammunition, you know, like French, American, and that's what really happens. And in the end, every single country and the leaders, despite how they are, you know, with exceptions, are pretty, let's say, nationalistic in this regard. They don't want Ukraine, like, give money to Ukraine so Ukraine produce own drones. So do you think, like, we, in fact, like, going back and some of the things when it's really an urgent moment, the reason is not this joint mindset. You know, I started to remember the COVID when countries were, you know, fighting each other at first for the masks, then for the vaccine, all these type of things. And that's what I see.
Yeah, no, completely. And actually, there are two levels to this, because one is every nation looking after its own. I mean, Estonia has been just amazing. Denmark has been amazing. Britain was really not bad. I mean, Britain gave a hell of a lot of kit very quickly, not particularly worrying where it came from. But there's that. And then on top of that, there's the position that Macron has represented, which is because we have to build up European defense, we have to buy European. So he was blocking until recently the Czech initiative and blocking people buying American because we have to build up and the European defense industry. Now, I agree with him longer term, but it's a confusion between the short and the long term, right? So you, I don't know if you know, but JFK, President Kennedy, had two inboxes on his desk. One was marked urgent and one was marked important. So the urgent thing is to get the stuff to Ukraine, wherever it comes from. Important, longer term, is also to build up an actual European defense industry, particularly if Donald Trump is going to be the next president.
More general question. I think it's important and let me dream a bit. I hope, you know, Ukraine win this war, but we also would, or even if we, the war is staggering, you know, how to preserve democracy, but, and also, you know, the states we want to have, the healthy states, the states which are not militarized, but which also, you know, are strong, and how to find this balance between, you know, security and, you know, not just building the country around the militarization, around the defense sector. I understand Ukraine can't do that now, but in the long run, we had the nice idea that we probably won't, we would have a professional army. I believe till the end of the century, for a while, we'll have the general conscription and a lot of countries might remain. How to live in this world? What is a major change and how to balance? Not to lose what we gain.
We did it in the Cold War. I mean, in the Cold War, West European countries spent 3%, 4%, 5% of their GDP on defense. We all had quite strong armed forces. We all knew exactly where we would go in the event of a war with the Soviet Union. I mean, there were detailed plans. And yet we were, you know, civilian countries, welfare states, social democratic, Christian democratic, you name it. So that I don't think it's impossible at all. I mean, I think there's a huge challenge for a country like Ukraine coming out of, you know, warfare, how you get back to that kind of democracy. That I can absolutely see. But I don't think for us, it's an impossible challenge at all. It's a bit more guns and a bit less butter, if you will. I mean, it's difficult for people to accept because at the same time, as you mentioned, we have such a heap of other problems. Yeah, I mean, climate change, you know. We've just passed the first 12-month period in human history when average global temperatures were more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels for a 12-month period. So that target that was meant to be the limit for controlling climate change, we're already passing it. So you've got that, you know, you've got inflation, you've got debt, you've got the fact that a lot of young Europeans think their life chances will be less good than their parents. That's not how it was meant to be. It was meant to be the other way around, you know. It was a project of hope. It was meant to be better. Things were getting better. So it is asking something of people, but I don't think it's an impossible ask at all, actually.
Tim, part of your, you know, most famous, renowned work is really about the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and all the processes which happened in Central Europe with democratization. Euromaidan revolution, the revolution of dignity, for me was like still one of this revolution for values. But we understand how the dictators managed to hijack also the tools of like democratic protest of the people who, you know, go to the street. All those things were hijacked and misused, you know, as any technology. And now we saw so many, you know, type of the anti-democratic type of protest. Some, by the way, democratic, but some also, you know. So how do you also see this turn, this curve in the global history, that do we are still hoping for this, let's say, type of the revolutions or type of the regime change in the authoritarian countries or the anti-authoritarian protest? Because there were some things we were observing in Russia, then in Belarus, in Iran, elsewhere, but we feel like they're failing. How do you see this process and how to deal with that, how to think about that?
Well, I think get smarter, learn from our mistakes, right? In a way, the first Velvet Revolution was the revolution of the carnations in Portugal in 1974, which actually toppled a fascist dictatorship. And then you had Spain, and then you had Greece, and then you had Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary and the fall of the wall. And then we had a whole slew of events up to and including the fall of Milosevic. Remember, Milosevic was brought down not by NATO or coup. He was brought down by, in effect, a Velvet Revolution. I was there in Belgrade. And the Orange Revolution, which I also witnessed, which we saw as being part of this sequence of Velvet Revolutions. But then, starting pretty soon thereafter, you could say Green Revolution in Iran, they've tended to fail rather than succeed, right? I mean, we could talk about Euromaidan, but now we're facing a series of failures. Belarus, 2020-2021, is one of the longest examples of sustained civil resistance in the history of civil resistance. I mean, these guys were amazing, coming out on the streets in freezing temperatures week after week after week after week. I still believe there's a lot of potential in that model, but the dictators have learned quite fast how to turn our tools against ourselves, how to use social media. And therefore, we just have to get smarter in terms of learning new techniques that might eventually prevail. And now you're going to say, what are those new techniques?
Not just. I'm rather speaking about the limits of the powerless, you know, and in their power, if we really speak about modern fascist countries like modern Russia? Or, you know, is it like really about not having techniques enough or the limit to how much you can confront this type of the regime?
That's a really great question. I mean, I think the techniques point is important because, you know, the bad guys are always learning too. So you have to keep adapting. And there is this kind of, there's some interesting work about by a woman called Zeynep Tufekci about how in the age of social media, it's very easy to do a flash mob. It's very easy to do almost spontaneous headless demos. That very seldom actually changes the regime. You need much more organization than that, okay? But also, it's never just the techniques. Techniques alone are never enough. Sometimes you need both armed force and civil resistance. Think of South Africa. South Africa had both. Think of Ireland, right? It had both wings. And also, sometimes it just doesn't work because the circumstances are too tough. And then you just have to keep at it and wait until those circumstances change. and work to change those circumstances.
One of your big places, which is also very darling to you, is Poland, the country which supported Ukraine immensely. But now we are observing an interesting moment where we have very, let's say, pro-Ukrainian government, democratic government. But we understand there are very systematic reasons for the Polish farmers' protests, you know, because, you know, there are some of the Ukrainian larger companies using the situation to bring grain, so there is, they feel threatened, and it's a very complicated situation. And probably I won't get into the whole idea about what is at the heart, practical issue of the Polish farmers' protest. But I'm thinking more in the terms of Ukraine becoming a member of European Union. While the war is ongoing, we do understand that a lot of people in Europe, because of this cheap labor, because of the some of the preference given to Ukraine, would think about Ukraine as like a threat, as unfair a competition. But how to deal with that in a moment that, of course, it's not a normal situation for Ukraine? You know, how to make it fair and to extend it's fair?
First of all, I actually chaired a great discussion with, amongst others, Olga Stefanishina and Radek Sikorski at the Munich Security Conference, which talked about exactly this, the Polish-Ukrainian issue. And one of the simple points you have to keep making is, here too, you need to win the war. Then the grain can go out through the Black Sea. It doesn't have to go on trucks. Then you can return to a more normal regime. That's point number one. Point number two, the way to address this, Natalia, is to recognize that this enlargement has to be done differently. And the real problem we have is, I literally just came back from Brussels, when was it, yesterday. And the trouble is that now you've got into the process. It's the same bloody bureaucratic process with all the tick boxes and the 144 veto points, and every single member state has to agree to the opening of every single chapter. In other words, it's being done the same old way, which kept the Western Balkans waiting for 20 plus years. So the message is clear. You've got to be much more imaginative, much more flexible, much more dynamic, and move fast in the areas where you can, without creating huge resistance in existing member states, places like Poland, and then recognize that you're just going to have to go more slowly in some other areas, because otherwise, you know, it's a community of democracies and there will be huge revolt. By the way, on Poland, the other thing is, you know, the complexity for Poland is, remember, this is a country that's trying to restore liberal democracy at the same time as being a good partner for Ukraine. Peace, Law and Justice, Prawo i Sprawiedliwość, the Kaczyński Party, is clearly trying to exploit the farmers' protest for its own purposes.
Timothy, with your recent trips to Ukraine, the ones which happened after the full-scale invasion, what have you learned new to you? As somebody who is exploring so many countries and societies within so many years, what is interesting for you? What are you learning?
Perhaps a simplest single word summary would be Ukraine. I mean, I've got to know Ukraine much better than I had before 2022. And, you know, what you have all been doing, including you personally and the Reckoning Project, is just amazing. And as I say, for me, Volia is one of the key words. I have also learned how difficult it is for a European society really fully to mobilize and win a war against a brutal, ruthless dictatorship. So to address a kind of sensitive issue, the issue of young men being called up to fight in Ukraine, you know, in a way, here's a thought for you. Tell me I'm wrong. In a way, part of that reluctance is evidence how European young Ukrainians are. Because if you've become accustomed to, I mean, I'm very, very struck by, because I mean, tons of young Ukrainians, you know, how completely European their experience has already been, right? They speak languages, they know the rest of Europe. You know, here I would have difficulty telling a Ukrainian student apart from a Spanish student or an Italian student or a German student. And part of being a young European, you know, actually is that this idea of actually going there to the front line and risking your life is in a way more alien than it was to older generations of Europeans, because that's what Europeans did every time. So it's a kind of, so Ukraine is in so many different ways, it also how we think about what we mean by Europe. If we say Ukraine belongs to Europe, where then does Europe end? So I would say, apart from being a very moving experience just in itself, and really the most moving experience for me over the last 2 years, it's also an amazing mirror in which we discover things about Europe itself.
I would think, would ask you how to think about Europe, because, you know, I'm engaged for the last year a lot in the project trying to connect Ukrainians with other continents, with Latin Americans, with Africans, with Asians. And in particular, Africans were really concerning, saying, look, like Europe for us, it's this history of colonization. Beware of the terms. And I think that there is all concern how we can speak about term global south, because it's just also like artificial term. And but the big advice is like, don't claim yourself be that European. Actually, there is some universal values. So for somebody like you who worked so hard for, you know, and wrote so much about, you know, modern Europe, how would you describe this term? Because I became also a bit cautious about using it like Ukrainians as Europeans, because it's larger than that. There is also the way to relate to a similar person in Buenos Aires, in Santiago, in Seoul, in maybe Jakarta, you know, so like, because I'm a bit afraid that also Putin wants a bit like to bring back this division between like the first world and the second world.
It's such a great question, because, you know, if we said about Bosnia or now about Ukraine, but this is a war in Europe, that doesn't mean that Ukrainian lives or Polish lives or Bosnian lives are any bit more valuable than Somalian lives or Palestinian lives or Israeli lives, right? All human lives are of equal value. And that can be, that's what people can hear out of it, right? And also Europe has this whole history over centuries, millennia, of claims of civilizational superiority, also through colonialism, right? So what we're saying here is, we love Europe and we think it's the best Europe we ever had and we want to belong to it, that our lives are any more valuable than anybody else's. But what I would say is, if I, as a Brit, you may remember we had an empire for a few centuries, go to India and start denouncing Putin's colonial war, some might think that's not very plausible. What about your history? But if you, as a Ukrainian, or someone as an Estonian goes and makes that argument, it should at least in principle be more plausible. Now, you've tried a bit of this, and I'm not sure how effective that argument actually is. But at least in principle, I think, you know, Central and East Europeans who've been the victims of empire, not the perpetrators of empire, should have a better chance of making that case.
I know you need to finish, but I probably still would like to finish with somebody in Ukraine. You mentioned already what Europe is, what you are learning also about Europe. Still, what were the maybe the most unexpected things for you, which you observed? And something it was maybe you didn't know about the country before or society.
Where do I begin? There's so many. Look, I would say maybe two things. One, the role of women, including yourself, but many others in this, is just fantastic. That just blows one away. The other is the extent to which Ukraine is quite consciously telling back to us, other Europeans, stories about who we are, who we are not. So I'll give you an example. Volodymyr Yemelenko, well known to you, says there were two ancient Greek ethoses, the ethos of agora, of the marketplace, and the ethos of agon, the ethos of conflict, of struggle. And he says, when you look at Western Europe, you see a hell of a lot of agora, the spirit of agora, of the marketplace, and not so much of agon, of struggle. And for me, that's such a great insight. I mean, you know, Germany, which is a country I know very well, is kind of 95% agora and maybe 5% agon. So the way in which really, really interesting insights, you know, not just into what is happening between Russia and Ukraine, but into us ourselves are coming to us from Ukraine. That's been a really interesting experience.
Okay, with that, probably I would leave you. I know you need to talk to regarding your award. Congratulations again, and we are looking forward to read it in Ukrainian as well and spread the word about it.
And I look forward to seeing you in Kyiv in mid-May.
Absolutely. And thank you. And all the best. Thank you for everything you do.